Hey everyone, this amazing ESO Network show is brought to you by our fine sponsor, Amazon.com. Please remember to shop Amazon for all your geeky needs, no matter what time of the year it is. All you need to do is go to ESOpodcast.com/ESOAmazon or click on the Amazon banner on the ESO Network webpage to go to our e-store. It's the best way to shop and the best way to support this program, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. Okay, that's enough of me babbling for now. Now on with your regular scheduled show.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Welcome to Earth Station 1, a weekly podcast dedicated to all things sci-fi, fantasy, and much, much more. Sit back and relax and enjoy the show.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Earth Station 1 podcast. That's right, folks. We are here, returning of the ESO Book Club. And this time out, we are looking at Watchmen, the Dave Gibbons, Alan Moore classic from 1986.
And it's 86, 87. Can you believe it's over, was that 30 years old?
It's over 30 years old, and it still feels as fresh as it came out tomorrow. And it's just awesome that way. And it's a great series. And we are going to spoil the heck out of it. So if you haven't read the book, go to the ESO Amazon store and pick it up. You could get it for fairly cheap. And it is well worth reading. If you've seen the movie, you'll understand who the characters are. But a lot of the stuff from the book was a lot different than the movie. So wanted to give that little bit of a, you know, spoiler, you know, thing, you know, little heads up for everybody out there. And speaking of heads up for people out there, let's say hey to my co-host this week. You heard him already. It's Mr. Mike Gorton.
Howdy.
How are you, my friend?
I'm starting to feel a little old. But, you know, all these anniversaries, I mean, Watchmen has this kind of anniversary this year. We just went over Black Hole last week, which is not an anniversary year, but it's old, or it makes me feel old because it was a long time ago. And Jaws had an anniversary this week because it came out in 77, right? No, 75. But yeah, they marked the day of when it came out. So there was there's a lot of anniversaries, a lot of things out there that are making me feel like, oh yeah, I'm old.
Oh yeah. There's tons of things I could do that. Hell, anytime I go to Hot Topic, I feel old. It's okay.
But they have Doctor Who stuff there now too. They didn't ever do that before.
No, they didn't. But you know, it's funny because when I go there for my pop figures and such, it's just like, you know, excuse me, sir, are you here shopping for your kids? It's like, no, I'm looking for myself. Oh, you might want to go down to, you know, down to Brookstone or to something like that. This is for younger people. It's like, oh, great. You know, and that's actually going to be my topic for this week's Rants and Raves is, you know, you're getting old when.
Old man yells at cloud.
Exactly. And it's getting to the point with, you know, myself and, you know, William's going to be 18 this year. And for me, it's weird because things like going to places like Hot Topic or going to places, you know, some of the music stores or, you know, they don't really have record stores at malls anymore. Even it's weird to see how some of the things have changed. And, you know, reflecting back on that, just thinking, you know, it must have been weird for our parents and stuff when they had to try to relate to us that way. Does that make any sense?
It's still odd when my parents try to relate to me. That never gets old, so to speak. But it's something that is definitely coming up. If you want to peel back the curtain a little bit, we're both around 50, right? So, I'm going to be there in about a year and a half. So,
and one of us is looking at smack dab in the eyes right now.
So that's, you know, we're not spring chickens, doing, this podcast, but we're still having a lot of fun. It does keep us young, I guess, to some degree, and makes us feel old, like you said, but what I think is really interesting, I was at, boy, there's nothing that'll make you feel older than going to the mall. And so Michelle and I went to the Mall of Georgia this weekend, and I'll tell you what, it's packed for one thing, which is strange because you think malls aren't really that busy anymore, but the Mall of Georgia must be the exception because there's a mall down the road from us, the Gwinnett Mall, and there's just tumbleweeds down there. But you go to the Mall of Georgia and it's packed. And so there's a lot of crowd, a lot of noise. And, but I could tell, I know that I'm getting older because, one, young people who cut in front of me annoy the hell out of me. And I'm like, you young whippersnappers. And then the young people that are polite will let me go ahead. Go ahead, sir. Like, I'm like this old man, on a walk that needs a walker. Like, oh yeah, I'm old. So they're letting the old man go first on the escalator.
Oh yeah. We got that tonight. And it was like, oh sir, you go ahead. It was like,
yeah.
It was excuse me, sir.
Excuse me, sir. Do you need help? Excuse me, sir. Like, you know, sir is not a bad word, but damn. Mm-hmm.
Well, that and Judy, what was it? Was at the grocery store at Publix, and she got, you know, ma'am, do you need help out with your groceries? And it was two bags.
Right.
And she looked at the guy and she was like, do I need to slap you right here? You don't want to do that to Judy. You really don't want to do that to Judy.
The other thing that was very strange is that, and I don't know if this is really a case of being old, it's just a sign of the times that I did not see coming. But we, so I went into the rock shop. Now, back when I was young, I really used to get excited whenever we went into Boston and we would go to Newbury Comics.
That was one of my awesome favorite place. Awesome place.
Stores in the planet. Like, because it was half music, really cool industrial music, half comics, really cool indie comics. And it was just a fun store. Whenever I went into Boston, you could find me at Newbury Comics. Now,
which location did Newbury you go Comic- to?
The one on Newbury Street.
Okay.
I believe that's the first one. Now, there's a bunch of them. It is a chain now, and there are Newbury Comics spread throughout Massachusetts now. But back in the day, there was primarily the one in Boston, and it was just awesome. But I noticed over the years, as I went there, the music content got more and more, and the comic content got less and less, to the point where I can remember one of the last times I went in there, like about, I don't know, 6-7 years ago. It was all music, some DVDs, and in a little corner in the back, they had some comics that were in pretty rough shape because they don't bag and port them. And they were just scattered throughout this little corner. And I think you could subscribe there. I think they had subscription boxes behind the counter so that, you know, you would get your monthlies or your weeklies if you wanted to. But apart from that, it was just a little tiny. And I was like, wow, Newbury Comics, the place you can't get comics anymore. And I was thinking that's pretty sad. Now, fast forward to this weekend, I go into the rock shop at the Mall of Georgia, which is a great store. You and I have been there many times. We've recorded there. We've talked to the manager there. Great store. Love it. They do some great events there, including Free Comic Book Day. Not saying anything bad about Rock Shop. I went there though with the intent, like, I'm like, you know what? I want to see if they have the new Prince Deluxe Purple Rain Ultimate Edition that just came out. So I thought this would be a cool place to go to get it. So I went in, and of course I'm looking at the comics, and there's tons of comics, tons and tons of comics, and in the back corner, in a little back corner, they have a few vinyl records and some CDs, and that's it. They didn't have the new print CD that I was looking for. They didn't have like a lot of new stuff. And it just was like, okay, so Newbury Comics got to a point where they had more records than comics, and now the Rock Shop is at a point where they have more comics than rock records. I was like, this is a very strange thing.
Well, it's always odd to see, because even now when you go to places like Best Buy or, you know, that kind of genre, Fry's, depending where you live in the country, you know, there's different chains. The CDs and the movies actually even are shrinking up because of digital downloads.
The digital downloads and, you know, places like Amazon.
Well, exactly. And it's more overhead to keep CDs and records and movies in stock where people can just order it online and have it shipped right to them where they can download it instead of having it on a store floor where, you know, they could sell toys or they can sell electronic devices, you know, watches or TVs and such instead, you know, where they can make more money. There's more overhead for them to, you know, be able to make more of a profit than they do with CDs and movies. And it's like, even if you try going to a Best Buy nowadays to get, you know, a new release, a lot of times it depends if it's not top 40 or a, you know, a mega big artist, you're not going to find new releases from some of the smaller bands that are still popular, but not such, you know, you'd have to go online to order it. You know, a lot of times if you try doing a search online and go, you know, looking for a local store, not anything in a, like a 50 mile radius and, you know, to get it. And it's just easier to get free delivery and it'll be at your house within 2 days.
Yeah. Yeah. The only thing about that, of course, with me is I'm so paranoid about, you know, to the condition of it in, and a lot of times, Amazon's condition is like whatever, you know, they just pack it in whatever way and it just bounces around and your corners are going to get bent and all that kind of stuff. So that kind of sucks. But moreover, I mean, for the price, it's like you can't, I mean, I hate to not go, well, and I don't feel so bad for like places like Best Buy and all that, because it's like, hey, they're big chains. You know, obviously when it comes to mom and pop shops, when it comes to local comic shops and that kind of thing, local record stores, I like to go and I love going to check out places like that. But and I will buy something almost every time I walk through the door just because I feel obligated to help out. There's no obviously competition with the, they can't compete against the rates that Amazon charges and places like that because it's just, it's so cheap.
Well, it's interesting because Amazon has been taking over and it's becoming more and more apparent. Look, they just bought out Whole Foods this last week.
They didn't buy out Half Foods or Three Quarter Foods. Nope, they bought Whole Foods.
Exactly. They bought Whole Paycheck out. It's awesome. And, you know, all those yuppies are going, oh my God, we were driving past Whole Foods this last weekend. And I tease Judy, says it's soon going to be Amazon.com Whole Foods or, you know, something like that. Or you'll be able to go to Whole Foods and pick up orders, you know, that you do on Amazon right there. Kind of like how Walmart is doing that. If you order anything on Walmart.com, you could pick it up at any Walmart store. And that's exactly the way it is going to be at, you know, Whole Foods now, I'm sure.
Well, it is crazy, and obviously it's, again, a sign of the times, but, you know, I mean, whatever it is, just, you know, we'll roll with it, and I'm sure everything will be, you know, I mean, you can't argue with the convenience of it, and, you know, that, and the prices, so that's a plus in some ways, but I don't know, as far as, like I said originally, you know, it's interesting to go to the mall and it's a different experience now. When I was growing up, the mall seemed to be like the cool place to go. Like I can remember just loving the idea to go to the mall because I lived in a small town and we didn't have a record shop. We didn't have a bookstore. We didn't have all that stuff. So, you know, we would go into Leominster and we would go to the Sears Town Mall and I would just have a ball because they had a Strawberries there, which is a great record store, a chain that was in New England. I don't know if they're still there anymore. I don't think so. And then we had a great bookstore, which I think was a Walden Books at the time. And I just lived in those two stores. And you know, it was a cool time. But there, it's a lot different now.
Oh, yeah. And it's interesting because even nowadays, there is no more malls are becoming very, you know, blasé. They're more of they're looking at more of the open, hate to say it, shopping centers where people both live, work, and shop. And they have the stores, and then they have the apartments right above them a lot of times. And they've just opened in, was it Alpharetta here? They did something called Avalon, which does something similar, but they did in Atlanta. They have Atlantic Station. They have, you know, throughout the country, there's different places. Just where we were in Huntsville in Alabama 2 weeks with the Earth Station Who, we were at Comcast Arboretum, and the hotel we were staying at was connected to a shopping area that was just all pedestrian friendly, all outdoors, but it was a mall, but it was outdoors. And, you know, it's becoming more and more popular, and the traditional shopping malls with the multi-floors and the different stories, you know, are, you know, just closing. They're not going to be, they're going away. And you're having a lot of the box stores, even, you probably are going to see within the next 5 years, the fall of Sears, and even possibly even the fall of JCPenney, you know, companies that have been, you know, mainstays for over 100 years. Going away. It's pretty amazing to see. God, we're sounding like two old guys.
Yeah, we are. And we sound like, you know, for those people who are familiar with Watchmen and what we're about to get into in a few minutes, we sound like the old guy who's got the magazine rack there.
Exactly. So, you know, you kids, be careful down there. Don't read that stuff. No, just kidding. We're never going to get that way, at least for the next 5 years or so.
Yeah, give me a few more years and I think I'll get there. But right now, I'm still young at heart.
Exactly. But with that being said, speaking of something young and neat, we have a new podcast joining the network. Let's meet them in a few minutes after we take a break.
Hi, this is Ashley Pauls with this week's What to Watch. We're coming up on the 4th of July holiday weekend, and I'm surprised that there's really not a big traditional tent pole coming out this weekend. A lot of times 4th of July is a time for a big, bombastic, fun special effects movie, but we really don't have that in theaters this weekend. However, we do have a couple fun movies coming out, so hopefully those will do well and maybe give them a chance to break out since they're not competing against a really big blockbuster. First up, we have Despicable Me 3, which is getting good reviews so far and looks like it'll be fun enough for fans of the franchise. It, of course, is about ex-supervillain Gru and his three daughters and, of course, those yellow minions, this time facing off against a villain who is a former child star from the 80s. Like I said before, it's getting decent reviews, so it looks like it could be fun for kids and families. Next up, we have Baby Driver, which is one of my most anticipated movies of the summer. It's an action movie filled with heists and car chases, and you know what? Isn't normally the type of movie I get really excited about, but it comes down to those magic words written and directed by Edgar Wright. Edgar Wright has been a cult favorite for a long time, thanks to his movies like Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz. He's a really funny, creative director, and I've been hoping that he'll break out on a larger level for a long time, and this movie could be his chance. It's a lean 90 minutes long, looks like it's got an awesome soundtrack and a fantastic cast. It's getting great reviews. I really hope this will be a breakout hit this summer, especially with Transformers not doing so well the weekend before and Baby Driver kind of having the movie to itself this weekend. Hope it does really well, and I'm looking forward to seeing it. Finally, we've got The House, which is a comedy starring Will Ferrell and Amy Poehler as parents who end up accidentally losing their daughter's college fund and have to start a casino in their basement to make up the money, of all things. Will Ferrell and Amy Poehler are two pretty funny people, but we've seen some comedies flop so far this summer, so I'm kind of curious to see how this one will do. If you're not in the mood to head to the theaters, there's a couple new movies coming out on DVD. We've got the Power Rangers remake. Didn't make as big a splash at the box office as the producers were hoping, I'm sure. But if you're looking for some nostalgia, could be a good one to check out on DVD. There's the remake Chips, which didn't really do a whole lot at the box office. And then the office thriller, The Belko Experiment, produced by Guardians of the Galaxy director James Gunn. Well, That's it for this week. Be sure to tune in next week, and we're going to be talking about Spider-Man Homecoming. Really excited to see this one getting some good buzz. How will it turn out? I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Welcome back. Now we have some big news, folks. We just are very proud to announce that ESO Network is growing once again. Let's welcome Al of the Night Blogger podcast to the show.
Glad to be here.
Welcome. Welcome to the station, sir.
I'm very excited. I've got a lot of podcasts to listen to now to catch up with.
Well, for those people who want to listen to your podcast, tell us a little bit about the Night Blogger.
All right. Well, it is a audio drama podcast, and it is about a blogger who investigates the supernatural and the strange, and usually gets in trouble. I try to keep humor and horror together with it. And I use actors to do the readings. Brian Mancy plays the Night Blogger, and then I have a few other people playing other parts. So it's like first person narration, but with occasional extra first person narrators jumping in.
Awesome. Awesome. Now it sounds like it might be inspired by the Night Stalker a little bit.
Maybe.
Maybe.
As long as I don't get sued by Johnny Depp, yes.
That's always no matter what you do, you have that concern. But what other inspirations? What made you think, oh, I want to do this?
Well, when I was using Tumblr a lot, they used to call it night blogging when you would just be up all night posting weird stuff. So that word stuck in my head, and I was like, night blogging, night blogger. Oh, the Night Stalker. So it sounded like a fun idea, and I used to do a lot of fiction. I tried to do one prose piece per week on my other website, and I kept doing night blogger stories. They got kind of stuck in my head, and I decided, you know what? I will see if I can do it as a podcast, because people were taking my horror stories that I wrote and turning them into creepypasta readings, like the No Sleep podcast and folks like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, you know what? I have been writing prose and posting prose and sending out prose for almost 20 years. I think I'm going to try to fiddle around with something else. And this has been an interesting challenge.
Is this a continual story? Can listeners join anywhere? Or is it, do they have to start from the beginning? Or what do you recommend?
I try to make it that you can jump in anywhere. Sometimes when you're in the midst of the end game of a story, like for instance, season two, which is just wrapping up now, I've had to have, I tried to do in one episode, I did catch up. Okay, this is what I'm doing and this is why I'm doing it. And then the episode after that, I was like, okay, we're telling the story in order. And you might want to go back and listen, but if you can't or you don't want to, that's fine. I've got problems of my own. I'm tied to a chair. But I also have bonus episodes, which are standalones that you can jump into. But my hope is that just like with old school Doctor Who, you'll just fall into an episode and have this kind of delightful confusion and want to catch up. I mean, I imagine anyone jumping into the Twin Peaks series right now. I've heard about Twin Peaks. I think I'll check it out.
Yeah, good luck.
Well, actually, that's how I came into Twin Peaks fandom. I just didn't pay much attention to it, but I heard the soundtrack. And I became very enamored of the soundtrack back in the day. And so finally I sat down to watch an episode, and it was the episode where Josie turned into a doorknob. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to have to catch up on this. No idea what's going on.
Right. Now, are you the primary, the sole writer of all the episodes? Do you have any assistants, or how does that work?
I'm the sole writer of the episodes. I have many proofreaders because I seem to always forget something. Word drops are my main weakness, my kryptonite. But the stories are all me. If someone ever sent me a story and I liked it and fit in, I might try. I've often said that I want to do adapt a couple stories from some friends of mine, but I just at this point we're still season two is going very well, but I feel like I'm still learning how to pilot this thing.
Awesome. Well, that sounds intriguing. Mike, I think this is the first time we've had a dramatic story-driven podcast on the network. Is that true?
Yeah, it is. It's actually neat because this is a big step for ESO, but, you know, it's a pleasure to have the Night Blogger part of it. I was actually a fan of your writings beforehand.
Oh, you knew those. Oh, okay.
I did.
The RPG ones or the fiction that, you know, wanders around the internet?
The fiction, of course.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Cause, my other jump in with semi-internet fame is back when I was still doing D&D and all that good stuff. I wrote, once a week, I would write a little, prose piece in screenplay format for some reason. And I would post it on the message boards of, the RPG Net website, and they would just be stories about my highly dysfunctional D&D group.
Oh, wow, of course.
Okay. Yeah.
Would you say, D&D then, cause that leads sort of my next question would be, what would you say is your primary, not all soul by any means, but your primary area of geekdom? Is it D&D or something else?
I would have to say it changes a lot.
Sure. But I get that.
You know, I will get obsessive about one thing and then I'll wander off and become obsessive about something else. Doctor Who has been my touchstone for since, you know, the 1970s, back on the when it was just the Tom Baker and Elizabeth Sladen episodes on constant repeat and that on the New York City stations on cable. But I also am a big fan of Lovecraftian fiction and weird tales, and especially enjoy, like, if you get a anthology like the what is it? The Cthulhu Cycle, Chaosium put those kind of things out. You'll read the story that inspired Lovecraft. You'll read Lovecraft stories, and then you'll read the stories that Lovecraft inspired. And I just love reading through that thread.
Very nice. Yeah.
If you pay attention, you can see all these threads through different stories, and it just really, it's one of my favorite things. It's even in Doctor Who, you see threads of how they're pulling up stuff from the 60s episodes that no one's ever going to see, you know, because the episodes are lost. And I just enjoy stuff like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, cool. Well, very cool. Well, we do have, since you're joining the network, we do have I dare say it's more of a ritual that we like to put everybody through. And that is, of course, the Geek Seat.
Exactly.
So without further ado, Mike, he's already familiar. I think the Geek Seat reputation has
Mike, he's so prepared. He tied himself up.
Yeah. Well, that's worked for me. So that's great news.
No, he is, you know, ready and willing. He was so excited to be joining the network. He said, I'll even do the Geek Seat for you, Mike.
Yep. Wow.
Yep. I brought my own clamps.
Hey, wait a minute. Where are you putting those clamps?
Now I'm a little frightened. Yes.
We see ESO. We take all types. It's good.
Yes.
All right, Al, your first question in the Geek Seat. You ready?
Oh, yes.
What was your favorite geek out moment?
The return of Doctor Who. When I heard Doctor Who was coming back, and then the first episode of the new series leaked, I had a really cheap computer and I only had a dial-up connection, and I had never found things on the internet before, media things, shall we say, and finding that episode, downloading it, having my computer crash, having to re-download it, and watching it at 4 a.m. and realizing, yes, it is back. And my God, they got it right. Was a great moment of nerdery.
Oh, sure. Sure, sure. I could totally see that.
But don't download stuff, kids. Don't copy that floppy.
Oh, no, 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 no. No, we do not condone that here on the network.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, that's it. Sure. All right. What was your most disappointing geek out moment?
I would have to say it was the movie Sleepwalkers, the Stephen King one. I was really excited about that. I brought all my friends to go see it. It's going to have, you know, it's a new movie written by Stephen King. It's got, you know, cameo from Clive Barker, and it was people shooting at cats with Mighty Morphing sports cars. And I was, you know, I was very disappointed.
Lots of cats. I remember lots of cats in that movie.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. That was...
Some people like it, but I was really disappointed with it. I wanted, you know, and not just because my friends were there, because I have no problem submitting my, you know, friends to, you know, horrifically bad movies.
That's how you tell what a true friend is.
This is true. And that's how I got banned from going to Blockbuster for a while, but now streaming has me back again. And horror will do that to you, because horror is the most heartbreaking of genres, because you go and I've never heard of this movie. Let's see if it's, you know, good, or look at all this hype for this movie. Let me see if it's any good. And horror is so subjective and it's so easily made. Like, you know, how much found footage is out there? Yeah, it's the most heartbreaking genre if you're looking for quality, and for whatever reason, that movie just completely fell on its face for me.
Okay. What geeks you out the most?
I would say what geeks me out the most right now is listening to some of the other audio drama podcasts out there. There's one called King Falls AM, and I am hooked. Holy cow, I am hooked. It is is very lighthearted, but you start getting really involved in the character, like one of those sitcoms where suddenly you're more involved with the plots and twists than you are with something on a soap opera. I look forward to that. Also, there's another one called The Magnus Archives. I just, you know, I get it and I have to listen to it. And so right now it has been, you know, audio dramas have been like, I just can't wait to hear the next story and I can't wait to be surprised. And there's a lot of great work being done.
That's awesome. What turns your geek off?
Let's see. I would have to say the fact that there's no pattern recognition in nerddom. The best way to explain this is if you've been following Doctor Who as long as I have, it's always the worst season. It's always the worst producer. It's always the show has lost its way. And if you read back enough, you hear people talking about the classic episodes, the Tom Baker ones. There was the American fan group, I can't think of the name, Doctor Who Appreciation Society. They had some scathing editorial about the episode, The Deadly Assassin, the one where the master came back and tried to frame the doctor for murder. And they were so outraged by it, they actually went into all caps. And, you know, this is pre-internet days. You know, what has happened to the magic of Doctor Who? And no one has realized that, you know, people have not realized the window of what we see. You know, this is, people are always saying that. And then 10 years later, it's like, oh my God, that's a classic. And people just don't, they're not patient. I don't think we're so immediately hooked into anything. We don't really ruminate on anything sometimes.
Mm-hmm. No, totally makes sense. No, I totally see that. What fictional character would you like to meet the most?
The Sixth Doctor. We have the same fashion sense.
Oh, I am so sorry there, man. Wow. Well,
he was my doctor. And what happened to him, I think, you know, because I was all about it. I really was, even though the scripts were bad, once again, in the 80s, you got, you know, when you were brought up in the 80s of Doctor Who, you used to that kind of stuff. But I thought he was really interesting. I really liked Colin Baker's performance. And what happened to him really stunk on all levels. And he was like, not only was he my favorite doctor, he also taught me that life is not fair and you got to roll with it. And, and now the audio adventures, I think he's really redeemed himself.
Oh, very much so. I agree completely with that. And Colin is just such a great guy. And he, you know, showed what he really wanted to do with that doctor in mm-hmm. the Big Finish stuff.
Exactly.
That's really cool. All right. What fictional character would you like to meet the least?
Despite that I'm very fond of the character, I would not like to meet Red Sonja because eye contact would be impossible and she'd probably kill me.
Well, I could see that. You think? What are you staring at, mortal? Yeah, I could see that.
And plus, now they moved her to the 20th century in some of the stories, and she's actually, I guess, I don't keep up with the monthly issues. I'm a trade paperback guy now. And I suppose, I guess she's in the 20th century or 21st now. We're in this, and she's like driving a Mack truck.
What?
So, yeah, I saw the cover of one of the new issues, and she's there with she's driving a Mack truck. You know, it's in some episodes she's riding a motorcycle. She's come through to our time, which she's done before, and apparently they're doing, you know, they're doing hijinks.
You think?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What is your favorite geek word, phrase, quote, or pose?
I would say my favorite geek thing is the saying "Sweet Zombie Jesus," which was in an episode of Futurama that then got cut out because everyone got upset about it.
Right.
I don't think I even see it in repeats anymore. It was the episode where Bender joins the robot mafia. And when Professor Farnsworth gets the bill for their restaurant, he goes, "Sweet Zombie Jesus." And now it says something else when you watch it, even on Cartoon Network at night, which was, you know, which usually isn't very worried about that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if they changed it on the DVDs.
I don't know. That's a good question, actually. So you can buy me some and I'll check it out.
Okay, Mike, now you have to do something for our guests. No.
Well, or if you guys, for our listeners, use the Amazon page and buy them yourself.
Hey!
Look at that. See, he's fitting right in.
I like this guy. What is your ideal geek occupation?
I would love to be a full-time writer in any capacity, you know, like being able to write the podcast full-time, being able to write books or anything else of that nature full-time. I think that would be fantastic. But I'm also, I don't romanticize it. I know that it's really not, you know, I know a lot of authors and I know that, you know, being a full-time writer isn't as glamorous as you might think. And, or, you know, you might imagine, or I might have imagined, but I still would love to have that idea of, you know, like Forrest J. Ackerman in his Acker Mansion writing stuff and having 10,000 different, you know, toys, you know, and having people come and visit him. And I would like to be maybe a grand old geek would be another way.
Well, that's awesome. What geek occupation would you not like to do though?
I think I would not like to be a one of those people who has to wrangle the celebrities to the set, you know, like, you know, Mr. Shatner can't find his girdle. Go look for it, Albert.
Mm-hmm. Oh God, that would be bad. Mr. Shatner can't find his toupee again.
Yes, yes.
Oof, that would be tough. Okay, yeah. I could see that. All right, Al, are you ready for your final question in the geek seat?
Of course.
He's too chipper. I don't know what about this, Mike.
I'm heavily medicated. So
okay. Gotcha. All right. Al, what is your ultimate geek fantasy?
I would love to be a character in I would love to appear in a horror film. When I was younger, I would have wanted to be like one of the protagonists, but now, you know, that I'm approaching 50 and approaching a certain amount of wideness around the middle, I think I could be the creepy janitor.
Okay. Wow.
Sorry. My first thought when you said creepy janitor, have you ever seen Student Bodies?
Oh yes.
That's my first thought of the creepy janitor. I'm like, yeah, good. Yeah. Well, that's,
yeah, I don't have the limit.
He's kind of cornered the market on creepy janitor.
Yeah. I'd be more like the janitor from the Nirvana video. It smells like Teen Spirit, you know, or Weird Al Party.
Okay. Yeah. Woo. Wow. That's a visual I'm not going to be able to get out of my head for a little while.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks for that one, man. Oh,
my pleasure.
I think the geek seat backfired on me on that one.
Yeah, exactly.
Wipe it down and move forward. That's all you can do.
Well, exactly.
Well, I don't know how to tell you this, but you've made it through the geek seat. Congratulations. You're now part of the station.
Okay. I'm excited about this. I really am. I hope to, you know, have a lot of, you know, be able to engage with your audience. And of course, I'm always, you know, my email's open and people want to say, hey, you know, have you ever considered doing this? Or, you know, this episode reminded me of that. I try to get back as, you know, within a semi-sane response time.
Well, we're very excited to have you. So for those people who are listening right now, in one sentence, tell people why they should be listening to your show.
Because you'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll kiss 20 minutes of your life goodbye.
That's, and it's only 20 minutes. Yeah, so there you go.
I'm trying it's to keep not, it 20 minutes.
It's not the torturous length that ours are usually, Mike. So that's a plus.
Exactly. Well, people like that, you know. You know,
well, riffing podcasts are different. You know, that's a whole different thing. You know, you guys, true. You know, you like Mystery Science Theater has trained us to enjoy people sitting down and riffing on a movie for a while, and it's actually very pleasant. It's like almost like you have someone to talk with about movies when you're not talking about movies. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand that. Well, absolutely. Thank you so much, Al, for being part of the network, and we are looking forward to having you, you know, on the show further, and you know, listening to further adventures of the Night Blogger.
Awesome.
Let's take a quick break, and we'll be back in a moment with the Watchmen.
My name is Brian Foster.
Everything you know is wrong. Got that?
Now, the reason that I'm calling is because I have begun to suspect you don't have any ladybugs in your freezer.
Hey guys, Roy here. So about your car.
The darkness was never empty.
There's this presence in my head.
I'm pretty sure that the book was confiscated by cats.
You're damn right we find a lot of bodies when Foster is around.
And some people call me the Night Blogger.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam. And admit that the waters around you have grown. Accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are changing.
Welcome back, everyone, and now it's time for the ESO Book Club. And this month, on this episode, we are covering the book, the graphic novel, the original comic series that changed everything in 1986, Watchmen. And we got a good crew to talk all about it. Of course, Mike Faber's here, myself. And joining us is, we couldn't do Watchmen without talking to the ESDCU guy. Drew Leiter is with us.
Hello, guys.
Howdy, sir. How are you?
I'm doing good. How you doing?
How's everything in DCU land?
That's going pretty good.
Good, good.
Are you surviving Rebirth?
Yes, I'm surviving Rebirth. Which...
Well, speaking of Rebirth, I know that some of, you know, we'll probably get into it at the end, but I know that Watchmen is on everybody's mind as far as DC goes right now, right?
Yes, it is.
And so this is very relevant.
It's the big mystery.
And also we have with us right from the Flopcast from Chicken Town, Kevin Eldridge is here.
Hello, guys. Great to be back on ESO.
Watches the chickens.
Usually the chickens are watching us.
When you're on the station, who watches the chickens?
That's why they have a mayor. Come on.
That's true. Yeah, good answer. The mayor watches the chickens.
There you go. Well, cool. I am glad to have you guys with us. Let's get right into it because this is pretty deep. First of all, as we, you know, start almost all our discussions, I want to find out exactly what your experience is with Watchmen. When you discovered it, how old were you, or that kind of thing. We'll start with you, Kevin.
Sure. I go back to the original 12-issue comic book series from 86, 87, and I probably heard it was coming through the house ads and Dick Giordano's columns back then, and I was also a subscriber to Comics Buyer's Guide, so I was keeping up on what was happening, and there was such an anticipation of this. Everyone knew this was going to be so big and so important. I remember Don Thompson, one of the editors of Comics Buyer's Guide, writing a special article just about how special and important this series was. And so I read those just month at a time as they were coming out back then, was how I first experienced it.
Wow. I do remember the promotions. I mean, that smiley face with the blood was everywhere. And the font, the Watchmen font and clocks, but just that marketing was everywhere in the 80s, probably from 86 through the 90s, really. It was in all the comic shops, and yeah, it was very strong. This was not a series that just kind of came out of nowhere.
Yeah. I mean, Alan Moore had the reputation already at that point from Swamp Thing and Marvel Man and the other thing. You know, he was certainly one of the more respected creators to come out of England already at that point, and everyone already knew this is the guy to keep an eye on that's really going to do something different.
Yeah, absolutely. Drew, what about you?
My first experience was reading it was in college. Somebody recommended it to me and loaned it to me because I wasn't collecting comics at the time it came out. I think I started collecting comics in 87, I think, or 88, something like that. And that's what I was only getting Batman and Spider-Man at the time. And I lived in a small town with no comic shop. So I don't remember. Yeah.
I used to ride my
bicycle up to the local drugstore and get my comics off the newsstand.
I am so sorry. I am just so.
You could not get Watchmen on the newsstand back then.
No, you couldn't.
This way, Watchmen was only in the comic shops.
Yep, it was direct market.
So I didn't have the option to get it at the time. So I actually, my comic selection was limited to what it was on the newsstand. So, but somebody told me about it later on, and loaned me their copy of it, and that's when I was introduced to it. And gotcha. Of course, I reread it. I don't remember when we did our Watchmen episode on Earth Station DCU. It was episode 16, I know that. And I reread it then. And I hadn't read it since then till, you know, we did it for our podcast. Gotcha. So it was good rereading it again because I'd forgotten a lot of stuff.
It's pretty dense. It's one of those books too. When you read it, you'll find something different every time.
Oh yeah,
yeah. It's pretty deep. Mike, what about you?
Same thing as with what Kevin said. I bought it originally, you know, in the single issues, because I was already a fan of the Swamp Thing work that Alan Moore had done, and to hear, you know, originally it was supposed to be the Charlton characters coming into the DC universe, because this was already after Crisis. And this is how they were going to introduce them. And so, you know, picking them up month by month by month, it was just, you know, it was the hot comic at the comic shop at the time. Starting off with the first issue, seeing, you know, the comedian being thrown out the front window. So,
yeah. I think the Charlton characters, that was one of Alan Moore's original ideas, was he heard that DC had bought the Charlton characters. So he thought, well, here's a way to use them. And well, I think by the time Crisis was going, that was not the plan anymore, because obviously Blue Beetle was in Crisis and they had a new plan for the Charlton characters. And I think with Charlton, the Charlton characters, Captain Atom and the Question and so on, those were Dick Giordano's babies, who was vice president at DC at the time. So I think it was Dick who said to Alan,
no,
you cannot do this to my characters. Just go and
exactly.
They're not going to be usable after this story. This is the end of those characters. So then Alan went in, and obviously you can see the resemblance. You can see the shadow of those Charlton characters in the Watchmen characters.
Exactly, but they're much, much darker than what they ever were in the Charlton era.
They're much darker than anything
that
we'd seen from a superhero story before this, I think. With the exception of, you know, Dark Knight Returns, this is pretty much the, like, at least mainstream, most adult comic superhero story that I could that first comes out, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So
I'm a little bit of it's funny because I'm not as young as Drew, but yet my experience with him is a lot similar because I also grew up in a town with no comic shop. So it would have been a trek for me to go and get this when it came out. And I remember seeing promotions for it. Of course, it was in all the comic books that I could get. Like there was ads for it in all the comic books that I could get in the Five and Dime and all that. But I didn't have any experience with Alan Moore prior. I didn't read Swamp Thing. I didn't, read any of that stuff. So I didn't really know him and his work. So it was quite a while until I read Watchmen. I would say it was probably, I probably got a copy of the trade. Well, I noticed that my trade copy is a seventh printing. So it was out for a while when I got it. I don't think I really connected with Alan Moore until League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Once I read that, I was so in love with it. I instantly had to read everything that Alan Moore had done. So I purchased Watchmen. I purchased V for Vendetta. I purchased a bunch of other stuff. And I've been slowly getting caught up ever since. But so it was much later for me. And so a lot of time had passed. So it wasn't as shocking to me reading it as it probably was for a lot of people reading it, including you guys in the 80s, because I was already familiar with, more adult or mature stories featuring superhero characters. But still the impact was still very, very big for me because it is an important book, not only for the industry and for the genre, but it's also, and I think it holds up pretty much still today, but we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But so when you guys first read it and on subsequent readings too, who or what, like who, what characters or what storyline within Watchmen really, really is the attraction for you? We'll start with you, Drew.
I like the Night Owl story.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And probably because being a big Batman fan, I was more drawn to Night Owl because he had the cool cave. Well, not a cave, but his basement and all his gadgets and stuff. I like that character.
Yeah, and I actually I think I identify with Dan more than anybody else, just because he's this kind of guy who, he's not totally committed, but he doesn't have a lot of confidence. Of course, he's got a crush on
Lori,
right? And yet, he doesn't really know what to do about that. And so I kind of identify with that aspect of him as well. He's really nerdy. Plus everybody else in this story is pretty crazy. So
oh, yeah.
Dan's like, I mean, he's really nerdy, but he's also pretty much, he and Lori are pretty much the two kind of normal people of this, like the straight men of this whole thing.
Well, he was a great character because he was also a second generation superhero.
Right.
And
yeah. And both of them, both he and Lori are.
Yeah, exactly. And that was one of the things I loved about it, DC was my comic company and I was a huge Golden Age hero, and for me it was like it felt like Barry Allen and Jay Garrick because it had Hollis in it also, who was the original Night Owl.
Yeah, they'd get together and have coffee and talk and stuff, or
exactly, because whatever, exactly, Hollis had retired and become a mechanic, and he lived on top of his place. He wrote an autobiography about being Night Owl during the 1940s.
And boy, did he let some stuff out in that biography.
Oh yeah.
Probably some stuff that he shouldn't have, but, Kevin, what about you? Is there another character in there that is drawn, or another storyline in there that draws you to the story?
Well, yeah, I'd probably tend to agree about Night Owl, just that was certainly the most relatable character, and both the Hollis Mason and Dan Driver. Again, I like the way Alan Moore sort of patterned the history in Watchmen after the history in DC Comics, having the Golden Age wave of heroes, then the Silver Age wave of heroes. To go with another character, I think maybe I would look at Dr. Manhattan next, just because that was obviously, besides just being the supernaturally powered character out of all of them, that was really the character who had the most, was most closely tied in with the storytelling format, where Moore and Gibbons were playing such complicated imagery and the layering of time travel, and having panels in the comics demonstrate different moments and times, and the captions, all that crazy storytelling devices that are layered upon layered through the whole thing. The Dr. Manhattan character was such a perfect vessel for that kind of storytelling, having a character who sees all of time all at once, because we're sort of seeing all of time all at once as we see that, especially that chapter that focuses on Dr. Manhattan, we're learning his history and seeing everything through his eyes, and everything's happening all at once. And it really was such a showcase of the potential of comic books as a storytelling medium. Here's something that you really could not do in any other medium.
Mm-hmm. Actually, Kevin, you might need to go to your wife to explain this, but it's wibbly wobbly timey wimey.
Oh, okay. Now I get it.
He's definitely a fascinating character. I mean, he's so powerful, and yet he has these flaws, and he's, you know, he's so unique, very unique. I mean, visually as well. I mean, let's face it. I mean, you know, to be honest, I mean, I think that was the first time I'd seen a naked dude in a superhero comic before. Mm-hmm. But there was so, like, it wasn't like sexy or anything. It was just like, he doesn't need it because he's just that powerful. And you're like, wow, he can just walk around. I mean, that's pretty powerful. You can just walk around naked.
It was just that he didn't care. He was becoming less and less human. So the clothing just didn't matter to him anymore.
Yeah. Cause you know, at first in his career, he sort of wears a uniform. He wears shorts just to make everybody else comfortable. But then after a while, he's just like, you know what? Screw that. I'm just like, I'm so beyond you guys. Like, I'm just, you know, I'm just going to just be myself.
I think one of the great storytelling devices they use here with Dr. Manhattan, him having clothes at the beginning of the story, and then as he loses them, it's also symbolizing him losing his humanity.
Yes.
Because you know, animals don't wear clothes. So I think it kind of symbolizes, as he loses his clothing, he's losing his humanity.
Well, even that one scene where, you know, you see him in bed with Lori, and, you know, then all of a sudden a second one of him appears.
Oh, man.
And then she sees that he's also at the same time, a third one is working on an experiment. And it's just like, it's like totally, you know, and she goes off on him, and she has every right to, you know, because he's lost what the meaning of humanity is all about. And that was just the interesting
arc of that character. Yeah, the arc of that character, in that by the end, through the conversation that he has on Mars with Lori, and then by the end, he finds a new interest in humanity, but he's still not part of humanity anymore. He's still moving further and further away from being human, to the point where he says something like, I do find humans interesting. Maybe I'll go make some. And then there's even a panel towards the end where he's literally walking on water. So not too subtle. the direction he was going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And but the thing is, you know, and this is not really overstated, but yet, despite the fact that he's losing his humanity, he's acting so childish, right? Yeah. Like, when they're called on him, when, you know, when all these people are, you know, when there's the whole thing about the cancer and all that kind of stuff, and he's confronted with it and everything like that, he just decides to take his ball and go home. Like, he's like, I'm just going to go to Mars. Like, he's just like, I'm out. Like, he doesn't stay and try to fix the problem. He doesn't like talk to people. He doesn't try to work things out. He doesn't even stay on Earth and try to, he could recreate Earth in his own image if he wanted to, literally. But instead he's like, I'm just going to go somewhere else. And, mm-hmm. And he also, you know, his relationship with Laurie is very complicated, but yet it feels like he needs her. Because he needs to, you know, he comes back and then they go back on Mars and talk because it's, I think he needs somebody to talk
and
to.
He forgets to give her oxygen.
I know. Right?
Yeah. Little details like that.
He quote unquote forgets. Right. but yeah, go ahead.
I think Laurie is a person that was keeping him grounded in his humanity. And when she started slipping away from him, you know, he didn't have anybody to keep him grounded, and he just secluded himself more.
Exactly. And when she started ending up with Night Owl, he didn't even bat an eye about it because he wanted her happy. And that was, you know, not to get into other types of relationships, but that's a true, you know, he was losing his humanity and his touch of it. And, you know, he loved her in his way, but he loved her enough to know that she needed to be with another human. And interesting.
I think, I don't know if love is a word that I would use with him there, but
I think he did at one point.
Accepted it. Yeah, I think so. But then, you know, he keeps going back to his first love, right?
Of course, the watch.
The one that with the watch, and the one that sort of his first love when he was a human, when he was John Osterman, right? So you've got sort of the two different loves of his life there.
Mm-hmm.
But his is a very fascinating story. But also, you know, I can't leave out, like, for especially around the 80s, at the time of the roguish and violent, ultra-violent heroes, you've got two represented here. You've got the comedian and you've got Rorschach.
And Rorschach was my character completely.
Oh, man. Yeah. Go ahead. What compels you to dig on Rorschach?
Oh, Rorschach was just so frippin' awesome. He was, you know, he was what you wanted Batman to be, pretty much. You had, you know, you had Night Owl, who was, you know, had all the gadgets, the things, the, you know, the flying owl and, you know, the utility belt. And then you had Rorschach, who was in the alleys. He was the one who, you know, literally broke people's fingers to get them to talk. He threw people off the side of buildings. He was the one, you know, who didn't mind getting himself dirty and, you know, being the one to be out in the streets, in the, you know, in the gutters, you know, fighting crime and to get whatever he was. He was a true, to me, I hate to say it, a Dark Knight detective. And
he's much darker than Bruce ever was.
Oh, completely. Well, as you saw, he was insane. But for him, his true identity was Rorschach. What was under the mask was, you know, was a face to him. And when he got put into prison and, you know, he said, you know, literally, it's like, you know, it's not me who's in here with you. It's you who are in here with me.
Yeah, and that was a very Batman thing to say.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
You guys are thinking that I'm in here trapped with you, but really you're in here trapped with me. Mm-hmm. And you know what? He backs it up. I mean, he is so dangerous in prison.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That scene in the kitchen and, you know, with the hot oil, and it's just amazing. And then when the gangster tries to get him, you know, somebody he had put away previously, you know, thinking that he, you know, pretty much had Rorschach at his mercy. No.
Definitely not.
But also, I think in reading this too, the sequence that got to me about him being in the prison was what he did to his psychiatrist. Because, you know, he starts off and then there's this psychiatrist that's this really nice guy who, for some reason, when I was reading, every time I read it, I think of Webster's dad, the actor who played Webster's dad on that TV show, that sitcom. Like, I'm thinking of like that guy playing him, because, you know, he's this lovable kind of positive thinking guy. But once you spend any time with Rorschach, you're going to go to a pretty dark place.
Well, and the story that they told with Rorschach about how he went off the deep end, you know, the story about the little girl.
Yeah.
And the origin, dogs.
Yeah,
And what Rorschach was seeing in the cards was just, it was horrifying. It would,
I guess, the doctor is kind of asking for it by sitting down with a psychopath named Rorschach and dealing out the Rorschach blots to look at.
he had it coming, Kevin says.
But I the character was amazing, but his sense of honor and, you know, how he, you know, every day was going through and tracking, because he was the one who was trying to solve the mystery of who killed the comedian. And that was the great thing about it. And it was perfect because how he was coming in and, you know, being, you know, the lead in the story. And then when, you know, basically, when Night Owl and him went out one night and, you know, fought some baddies, and, you know, at the end of the evening, you know, Night Owl was like, "Hey, that was great. Whatever happened? You know, that was a lot of fun. Whatever happened?" And Rorschach's walking down the tunnel, going back out to the street. He's saying, "You quit." Literally, you know, he never stopped. And it was just amazing to see.
Now, what do you guys feel? And because, yes, I mean, if people haven't, you know, noticed by now, we are spoiling this big time. So
we mentioned right it at the end, beginning of the show, Mike. Don't worry.
I do think, what do you think of Rorschach's death? I mean, I assume death. I mean, Manhattan zaps him, and I'm assuming he didn't, even if he put him on Mars, I doubt he gave him oxygen.
He died in a Rorschach test, if you look at the blood splot.
Right. So there you go. Yeah. So, but do you think, like, because that to me seemed, I don't know, it seemed really weird. Like, it didn't fit really with me. I don't know about you guys, but that sequence didn't fit with me.
Well, basically, he's, at the end, he's the only one that's willing to hold up his standards. The other ones want to keep what happened in New York a secret. And Rorschach's the only one that wants to reveal what actually happened. And, of course, Dr. Manhattan's not going to let him do that. So he basically tells him, go ahead and do it. Because the only way they're going to stop him is by killing him.
Exactly. The only way that's exactly where I was going to go with that. And because he was so into, you know, his crusade that he said, no, I'm not going to let him get away with this. And yeah, this is going to cause peace, you know, between the U.S. and Russia, because through the whole story, that was the whole thing about tensions building between the Cold War, because it was an alternate universe where Richard Nixon almost became president for life. And the Cold War basically continued through that. And it was literally, that's what the whole thing with the clock was, you know, counting up to midnight. And that, and Rorschach, you know, because of what happened in New York, you know, everyone was like, oh, this is going to cause peace. And that was the whole thing behind, you know, Ozymandias. Is that how you pronounce his name?
I always call him Ozymandias.
Well, his mission was to, you know, cause to do this. And that's the whole thing that caused the death of the comedian, the whole storyline. Sure. And, you know, but at the end, the final scene in the book, literally, is, you know, the newspaper getting Rorschach's diary with everything that happened.
Well, yeah, I love that being the final page. I thought that was a nice way to wrap it up with the ketchup dropping on the smiley face on that guy's shirt.
Yeah.
As far as the death of Rorschach, interesting thing about that is, I mean, Rorschach was killed for essentially for the story purposes at that point, and that's the end of the story, so that's all we have. There are a couple of hints that maybe Dr. Manhattan did not actually kill Rorschach, that maybe something else happened to Rorschach. One of which is that when Dr. Manhattan earlier in the story is saying that his view is cloudy for that time period, even though normally he can see all of the past and future, but he says he can see himself, it's blurry, but I'm standing in snow, I'm killing someone. So he says that I'm killing someone in that scene, but he also says it's fuzzy, it's blurry, I'm not quite sure. The other thing is that in the they did a role-playing game when DC was doing those role-playing game modules in the 80s. They did a Watchmen role-playing game module, and Alan Moore had a hand in doing some of the writing for that module, believe it or not, at the time. He was still on good enough terms to do that. And there's a summary of the whole story of Watchmen in that game module. And in that summary, when it gets to that scene, it says that Rorschach is apparently disintegrated. It doesn't say killed. And again, it's a moot point. Yeah, it's a moot point because the story's over. But it's fun to think that, well, maybe something else happened there.
Yeah. So talking about the characters, and I know we haven't talked about every one of them, but we've hit most of the big ones. And it is important, I think, looking at the characters and particularly the story, when it came out originally. You could argue that superheroes just hadn't been depicted this way. And the way the story plays out, one of the superheroes is the big bad guy. And then three of the superheroes that are considered like cool guys align with the bad guy at the end. And the two that are violent and crude and murderous and rapists are killed because they don't agree with the bad guy. It's a very, like, it is a, like, topsy-turvy way of a superhero story. Like, superhero stories weren't like this before. I mean, Superman was like, da-da-da, like, you know, they would always come out on top. You'd have some exceptions to this, but this is really a different way of looking at superheroes, top to bottom. And how did you guys react to that when you first read it? And do you appreciate it now? Do you think it holds up? And do you think that this, along with a couple of other things like Dark Knight and everything, was the start of the loss of innocence for superheroes? I know it's a bit loaded question, but we'll start with you, Mike.
Well, for me, it was something brand new for American audiences, especially because before that, you know, I was familiar with Dave Gibbons' artwork from Judge Dredd. Over in the UK.
Sure.
And, you know, Judge Dredd was almost as dark in a lot of ways. Sometimes it was humorous. Sometimes it, you know, was very, very serious. And you had a lot of comics like that coming out of the UK, and it almost fit. And this was also the beginning of the Vertigo era, you know, right before it broke and such. That's when you had started having Sandman and all that type of stuff. And this was a neat experiment to show the US and to use characters, you know, that are mirror images of ones that we're familiar with. And, but to a very dark, dark state, you know, the whole thing with the comedian raping Lori's mom, the whole thing with, you know, how the comedian got the scars in Vietnam, you know, by the concubine. You know, it's just amazing. You did not see stuff like that in a lot of DC, in DC or even Marvel at the time at all. And, you know, this is also the same time you had, you know, in Marvel, you had like the new X-Men happening, you know, Byrne and Claremont. You had, you know, all that kind of stuff. George Perez was doing the Avengers. You know, you had lighter things, you know, yeah, you had Dark Phoenix and stuff, but you did not have anything like the Watchmen. This was all brand new.
And it's a good point you make, because originally, you know, the dawn of superheroes in the Golden Age was really led by DC, Superman, Batman, and everybody else that followed. And they were these pretty much one note, you know, not very deep characters, but they were fighting for justice, American way, that kind of thing. Then Marvel came along and had the superheroes a little deeper, rooted in reality. They had real world problems. They had to deal with, like, you know, part-time jobs as well as being a superhero and all this sort of thing. And that changed everything. Then almost as a reaction to that, later on, like a couple decades later, DC comes out with these things where it's like, okay, you want your superheroes like a little bit more rooted. You want them like dark. We'll show you how dark they can get. And boy, like this book, this story, even in more than Dark Knight Returns, I think just is like everybody is got issues, and that's an understatement. That's putting it mildly. So it's a really different take. I want to hear more from you guys. Drew, what about you?
All right. Well, I think Watchmen and The Dark Knight Returns, they started this, especially at DC, they started the comics down a dark road. We start seeing stories like Nightfall and
Death of Superman.
Death of Superman. Hal Jordan killing the Green Lantern Corps.
Yep. Wonder Woman gets replaced in the contest.
So
the major heroes get replaced. I mean, you know, it's around the same time that Barry Allen dies and we get a new Flash too. So you're right. It's it's a big changeover.
Yeah, oh, exactly. We see this big change. So I think, you know, this and The Dark Knight Returns were the two stories that started all that. And I think the other thing I like about Watchmen is it introduces a smarter villain. Ozymandias, one of the things he does in this story is when he's doing his monologue about his big plan.
It's already happened.
There's nothing they can do about it. It's already happened. Mm-hmm.
He's not a Bond villain there. No.
No.
So there's nothing they can do about it except decide what they're going to do now that it's happened. And everybody besides Rorschach decides they're going to keep it a secret because it's going to change the world for the better.
Yeah, it makes sense. Makes sense. Kevin?
Yeah, this story is morally messy, and that by design. And so it was raising so many questions and making so many challenges to how superhero comics had always worked in the past. And so you're left doing a lot of questioning and wondering at the end as far as, well, did the good guys win? Is this better now? Is it going to be worse now? What just happened? And that's exactly the kind of reaction that the storytellers were going for here. As far as its context in the other kinds of comic book stories that came in its wake, I think that that there was a pretty drastic fall off in the quality after Watchmen and after Dark Knight, in that you can't just say, oh, okay, dark, super violent, dark, horrifying comics. That's better. That's what we should do now. Well, no, you need brilliant storytelling and characters to back it up. We don't just want something to be dark because it's dark. Mm-hmm. And I think Alan Moore, there's a quote from Alan Moore, some interview about Vertigo, about the Vertigo line, which didn't officially start until several years after he had left DC, of course, but he has some line like, they based a whole comic book line on a bad mood that I was in 1984.
Yeah, because, you know, for those not familiar with him, I mean, a decade later, I mean, he was working with, you know, doing like superhero books that were a lot more uplifting, like Tom Strong. And sort of like trying to, almost like he was trying to rewrite the ship, you know, like going, hey, like, you know, I did dark superheroes when they weren't a thing. Now all of a sudden everything's dark. So I'm going to go and do lights, you know, go back to doing light superheroes when, you know, they're not a thing. So, yeah, very interesting. Do you think It's just a fact. I mean, you can argue the merits of the story. You can argue and criticize this book all you want, and a lot of people have. Certainly, it's been accused of, you know, its popularity of changing the industry for the worse. Like, as you said, it led to a lot of darker stories, some of which we're still getting. And a lot of people point to this period of time specifically with Watchmen, saying it ruined everything. But so it obviously was a game changer.
Oh yeah.
But do you think that it's just a game changer, or is it, like, you know, because it's like, we all have there are classic stories out there. There's books that, you know, you're in school and you're told to read these because they're quote unquote classics. You're told to watch these movies like Citizen Kane because they're, you know, classics. They're really important movies to watch. And Watchmen is in that level where not only as a comic, but as a actual story of fiction, you know, this is important. This is as Drew said, I mean, the college will issue this out to read as a classic. Do you think it's a product of its time? It's a game changer, or do you think it really still holds up? And we'll start with you, Mike.
Oh, I definitely think it holds up. It's interesting too, because now a lot of the scenes are so iconic. The scenes of Dr. Manhattan walking through the jungles of Vietnam, the images of him exploding by the photons, you know, both in his origin and then when Ozymandias, whatever you announce his name as, you know, when he tried to destroy him, and then him coming back and saying, "You think that's going to try to destroy me? I've destroyed myself so many times," you know, and being like almost 100 feet tall and crashing his arm going through the window and everything. It's just,
I'm waiting for the pet to come back, like as a hugely powerful being. Because if he did that same thing to him, like, the pet should come back and go, "Hey, like, I'm really powerful now. Deal with me.
Maybe that's who's behind the whole rebirth.
we'll get to that a little bit later, but yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I just think it worked. It works still very well. I've read it, like, jokingly, you know, I teased Mike and say, you know, I haven't read it yet. I'm going to read it tonight. And I read it in, you know, I read it, started last night and read it during the day today, you know, on my lunch break and then a little bit at work. And it is still an enjoyable read. It's hard to put it down once you start. And that's what's great about it. Because it still feels fresh.
Yeah. Well, Kevin, what do you think?
Yeah, this absolutely holds up as a classic in comic book history. And it is also of its time, and it's set in the mid-80s. It's a Cold War story, and that's where it works best. And it's kind of a period piece at this point. But it's such a beautiful and amazingly executed piece of work that it absolutely will always hold up. It rewards studying. It rewards rereading. And as you said, Mike, that you'll see things in it every time you read it. You will catch little touches and points that, oh, I don't think I even saw that before. I want to make sure that we credit Dave Gibbons as equally as Alan Moore for this story, because this was absolutely a partnership and a collaboration. And the achievement, the visual achievement by Dave Gibbons in this story is absolutely remarkable. He was a brilliant artist at the top of his game. And just from a design standpoint and an illustrative standpoint, it's absolutely an amazing piece of work. I like all they kind of set rules for themselves as far as storytelling and layout. And you get just those 9-panel grids on each page, and nothing really breaks those 9-panel grids. They'll go to a big splash sometimes, but it's always keeping to those same grids. And they decided there wouldn't be any thought bubbles. You don't read anybody's thoughts through this. There are no little narrative caption things. Meanwhile, in Dr. Manhattan's lab, you don't get any of that. There are no sound effects. You know, the telephone rings in Laurie's apartment, you don't get a big ring word popping out of it. You just see Laurie turn to the telephone. And there, as a reader, you, okay, the phone's ringing. She just looked over at it and picked it up. So it was really stripping all the conventions that had piled up in the comic storytelling medium down to the very basics of words and pictures. And Dave Gibbons even lettered this thing that's penciled, inked, and lettered by one guy. And just, you can just pour through the designs of it and just get caught up in how deep it goes. That city block in New York City with the newsstand and that whole area, that was designed mathematically, almost like Dave Gibbons knew exactly how that block of New York City was arranged and the architecture and which building followed which. And as you can see it from different angles, as the different characters move through, there was a logic working in this story. So much thought visually went into this than in anything I'd ever seen before.
Yeah, excellent point. I mean, yes, it not only is the story incredible and powerful, but the way that it's that Gibbons and Moore tell it, they put on a clinic of stories that of comic sequential storytelling that we're still learning from.
Yeah,
absolutely, absolutely. Drew, what about you? Do you think it still holds up?
Yeah, I think it still holds up, and making an impact. We're seeing it now in the DC universe right now, the impact it made. And when you pick this up and you start reading it, you don't know these characters at all. So the story does a good job of bringing you in and wanting you to learn more about these characters and getting you attached to them. So when you get towards the end, how drastic it makes you feel, or, you know, the dread or what these characters are going through.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it is interesting that they are, DC is, I mean, a few years ago, they celebrated, I believe, an anniversary by coming out with prequel stories. And of course, Alan Moore has washed his hands of everything DC and including everything Watchmen. So he's no longer associated, but they did come out with some, I think, fairly popular stories that were set in the Watchmen universe a few years ago. And then now with Rebirth, they pretty much all but said that come November, I think, right, Drew? Is that when the big crossover happens? That Watchmen definitely has, literally it's big blue hands in the DC universe.
Yes, I believe it starts in October, and we're gonna get to see more the beginnings of it in September, because we're gonna find out if anybody's been following what's been going on in the DC universe. You know that Tim Drake was taken, he was about to die, and he was taken out of the DC universe and put in a prison by this mysterious Mr. Oz, who everybody thinks is Ozymandias, but I'm beginning to think that that's a red herring. And only because of the solicits that came out last week for the upcoming story about that. So it's really interesting to see. We're pretty sure that Dr. Manhattan is behind the new 52. If you know the story of Flashpoint, yeah, this is
someone's really finally taking the blame for the new 52.
It's about damn time.
That makes him a villain right there.
So you have the Flashpoint storyline where you have Barry going back and saving his mother, and it changes history. And once they fix that timeline, when Barry comes back, he comes back into the new 52, not the old post-crisis DC universe. And Rebirth is all about taking the characters, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, all the characters, and bring them back to what they were post-crisis. So, you know, bringing the hope back into the DC universe. There's been some great stories in DC Rebirth, but supposedly Dr. Manhattan's behind the new 52, and we don't exactly know why he created the new 52 or why he took 5 years of the heroes' lives away, but it's been slowly unraveling, and it's been very interesting as we see these story tidbits working through all the different titles of the DC universe.
The most iconic things, of course, is that the button, the comedian's button with the blood on it, was found in the Batcave, and they did a whole 4-part team up between Batman and the Flash called the Button storyline, which is going to lead into, of course, the October crossover as well, the October event. But one question that I have is that, you know, like, how did that button, like, because the last time we saw that button in Watchmen, what's his face throws it in the grave of the comedian. So the comedian's grave, I think it's Dan throws it in there, right?
Yeah. And it didn't have blood on it anymore at that point either.
Yeah, because he wiped it off. So it's
he scraped it off in the kitchen.
Yeah, that's sanitary. anyway, so lots of stuff. Look, it's still something that's going on, but whether you like that or not, it's not necessary to enjoy this. This does really stand on its own. I definitely encourage people to check it out. It's not for everybody. Obviously, but but I think for those people who enjoy superhero stories, it is a different take on superheroes in a way that will make you rethink them. And they call it a deconstruction of them. I know in some cases it's been seen as a parody. I don't quite see it as that funny, but there is some dark elements to it. Look, we haven't even talked about the Black Freighter.
But I don't think we have time, Mike.
We don't have time. No, we could develop a whole podcast of the Black Freighter. So yeah, we don't need to do that. But in any case, any last words on Watchmen, Drew?
If you like this story, and I think if you want to see further happenings of it, check out some of the DC Rebirth titles. Check out the Button crossover. It's very interesting to see what they're going to do in the future with these characters. Because I do believe they're coming back. And
go ahead.
What's that, Mike? I was going to say, I'm even expecting Rorschach to show up, so.
Are we? Yeah, well, he could, because maybe that's where he zapped him to. Mike, are we rating these? We're not rating these, right?
No, not the book club stuff.
Gotcha. All right, Kevin, last word?
Because they're all fives. Hello, come on.
Of course.
Yeah, I would just say, as far as all the follow-up projects that have happened now related to Watchmen, and they're piling up now. We had those Before Watchmen stories a few years ago, now the Rebirth series, the movie. Now there's talk of an HBO series. I read another script for a movie years ago. Sam Hamm, the guy that wrote the Batman 1989 movie, he actually wrote a Watchmen script right after that, which I found a copy of a while back. So I've read several different interpretations.
Is that
of
the
these.
One that Gilliam was supposed to direct?
Because I yes. know that, yeah, Terry, that Gilliam, Terry Gilliam was attached.
Oh man, that would have been yes. Oh man, crazy. But go ahead.
That would have been interesting, yeah. And obviously, we don't have time to go into it, but that script was much, much simpler. It was okay. You know, it's fun to read. It's probably floating around online these days if you look for it. I'm okay with all those extra things. I just look at them as weird extra bits that I don't consider part of the real Watchmen story. Their existence does not affect my appreciation of the original story. And if they're good, if they're bad, fine. If they're good, great, I'll enjoy them. If they're bad, I'll not enjoy them. I'll ignore them, and I can always go back to the original. So
it's like
regardless
the
of the feelings of yeah. So you know the real book is still there. It's always going to be there. It was written by Alan Moore, even though he certainly wants nothing to do with any of this at this point. It was written by Alan Moore. It was drawn by Dave Gibbons, and it is absolutely a classic.
Last word, Director Faber.
It's awesome. It's amazing. I loved every second of it. The books were great. I didn't enjoy the sequels as much, or the books afterwards. You know, were
right. Before with, Watchmen. Series.
Exactly. It just didn't do it for me. I read all of them. The Rorschach one was the closest one to anything I really liked. But, you know, I'm really glad what they did with the movie, and I think they did it the right way. And, you know, Terry would have done great with Watchmen, but I think I'd like what they came up with, and I like that they changed the movie up a little bit, because that alien monster that, you know, appeared and destroyed half of New York would not have made the movie. It would have not at all.
It was, yeah, I don't blame Zach for cutting that out.
No, but I enjoyed it, and it was funny because reading the book this time, I actually heard the movie characters' voices in my head reading it.
Ah, look at you. Yeah. Well, some of them were so well cast. I mean, your buddy Rorschach, I think that's probably the best cast guy in the lot, right?
Mike, he's not anybody's buddy. I don't want him to be any.
And isn't the comedian played by, what's his name? Jeffrey Dean Morgan, who's Negan
yes.
now?
Yes.
Yeah. Awesome.
I thought the casting was excellent across the board with one major exception, and that was Ozymandias, I thought, was completely off the mark in the movie.
Billy Crudup was awesome, though, as Dr. Manhattan.
Everybody was great. Everybody looked perfect. Ozymandias, I don't even recall the actor's name, but he played it he was so cold and creepy through the whole thing that he just seemed like a creepy villain from the start of the movie. Whereas in the original story, Ozymandias was brilliant, and he knew how to come across as being warm, and he knew just the right thing to say in every social situation, and he made people feel at ease, even though he was a genius. And that was completely lost in the movie. But I really enjoyed the movie overall, though.
Yeah. It's been a while since I've seen it, so I need to redo that or rewatch. And maybe we'll do a podcast about that as well. But in the meantime, thanks, guys. And for all those people listening to our book club, if you've got some things that we didn't mention, because I know that there's a ton that we didn't get a chance to mention about The Watchmen, feel free to write us. We're also going to post this, of course, on the Facebook page. So there'll be a big discussion there, I'm sure, about it. And it'll be great to hear your thoughts. So thanks, everybody. And we'll be right back with the Con Report.
This is Michelle with the Iconic Rock Talk Show moment. In music news this week, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is franchising, sort of. They're opening a second edition of the museum in Tokyo, and it will open with a temporary exhibit that has yet to be named. Eventually, they will find a permanent home in central Tokyo. The Cleveland Museum will be in creative control. They say they plan to send over exhibits that have previously run and closed in the States, and also create some new ones from their existing holdings. The new Foo Fighters album is called Concrete and Gold and comes out on September 15th. This one Dave Grohl calls the first record he's ever been proud to play for people. He says it's got insanely heavy Foo Fighters riffs combined with lush harmonic complexities, and describes it as Motorhead doing Sgt. Pepper. He hints at some different guests that are going to surprise people. He says the biggest pop star on the planet is singing backup on one of their heaviest tracks. Early speculation is that it's Adele, because they have a new producer for this one named Greg Kurstin, who's been linked with a lot of people. He's worked with Adele, Pink, Beck, Ellie Goulding, Lily Allen, and right now he's working with McCartney, so we'll see who that is. They've let 3 or 4 songs out of the bag already. You can go to YouTube to see a live version of Sunday Rain with Taylor Hawkins on lead vocal, recorded in Europe. The Foos are on tour in North America October 12th through December. Tickets went on sale Monday the 26th, so if you want to go and don't have any, check and see if there's any left. Of course, this past weekend they played Glastonbury. They headlined the Pyramid Stage with a 2-hour set Saturday night. Radiohead did the honors Friday night, and everything wrapped up on Sunday with Ed Sheeran. Bruce Springsteen is set to play an intimate Broadway residency this fall. He's going to play 5 shows a week for 8 weeks at the Walter Carr Theater, which only seats 975, I think, is the capacity. Less than 1,000. It's rumored that this is a lead up to staging a musical based on his memoir that came out last year called Born to Run. New releases to check out right now include Evolve from Imagine Dragons, Big Boy's Boomiverse, Calvin Harris has a new one called Funkwave Bounces Volume 1, and TLC is back with a self-titled album. Alison Moyet, her new album is called Other. If you love your 80s music, you might remember Alison from a British band called Yaz, a.k.a. Yazoo. If you don't know her, she is very much worth checking out. So many great female vocalists out there now, and she just has a one-of-a-kind voice. She deserves to be up in the conversation with all these great women. On the blog this week, iconicrocktalkshow.wordpress.com, have a little birthday card for our neighbors to the north in honor of Canada Day. Check it out.
Watching the detectives. Watching the detectives. Watching the detectives. Watching the detectives.
Welcome back. Now it's time for the ESO Con Report.
Well, over the next couple months, here's where you can find ESO Network folks like me and Mike and other fine people of the ESO Network. Starting this weekend, actually, June 30th through July 2nd in Chattanooga, Tennessee, it's LibertyCon. The host of the White Rocket Network of podcasts, Van Allen Plexico, and a great author in his own right, will be there. I doubt he'll have copies of his podcast, but he will have many copies of his books, which I definitely recommend you check out because they are solid. I love his science fiction series. They're great stuff. So check out Van and Chattanooga this weekend. And if you're in the Atlanta area, on July 2nd at the Atlanta Comic Convention, it's a one-day show held at the Marriott Century Center, and it's a great time. I wish I could be there, but unfortunately I will be out of town. But Mike Faber, the director himself of the ESO Network, will be there looking for cheap trades and pop figures that he does not already have.
Exactly, or whatever cheap I else can find, you know?
Sure. And there's a lot of friends of the station that are going to be there as well. The award-winning Bobby Nash will be there. He's got, I think, three new books that since the last Comic-Con to make their debut there. So check out his new books, as well as lots of other folks usually pop up there. It's a great meet and greet for us, actually, because it seems like every time we turn around, we see somebody there we know. So it's I'm going to be sorry to miss it, but I like I said, I would be out of town, but Mike, you'll have to do it all for me.
I'll make up the slack. Don't worry.
Definitely. And then next weekend, July 6th through the 9th, Convergent Convention in Bloomington, Minnesota. Kevin Eldridge, who's on this very podcast, he will be at that convention. He will be walking around. I believe he'll be participating in some panels, might even be recording some segments from the Flopcast, as well as handing out. Look, I'm going to put him on the spot. He's going to be handing out stuff. So if you want something cool, just look for Kevin, and I'm sure he'll dig deep into his pockets and see what he can have for you. So anyway, it's a great time. So if you're up in Minnesota, say howdy to Kevin. Then the weekend after that, July 14th to the 16th, is Congregate. It's also the Deep South Con. It's a combination of these two great conventions all in one. It's in High Point, North Carolina, and Angela Pritchett, the geek girl herself, will be there. She will also be in August 11th through the 13th at Otakon in Washington, D.C. Hope I pronounced that right. It's O-T-A-K-O-N and in Washington, and Angela will be at both of those shows. And that's about it as far as the next 2 months. Now, of course, we'll be gearing up for Dragon Con, which you'll find almost all of the ESO Network in some form will be there. Almost every network show that we have will have at least one or two co-hosts, guests, personnel at this convention. It's a huge convention, but it's one we also really, really love and we enjoy. So if you are going to be at Dragon Con, please reach out to us, say howdy. If you want to coordinate with us ahead of time, obviously our Facebook group, We've got the phone line. We've got an email address if you want to know more information. But if you want to know all there is to know about the Dragon Con report, the Dragon Con convention, I definitely recommend listening to the Dragon Con report, which we put out every month. We're recording a new one this week, so that should be out pretty soon in a few days. So as you're listening to this, so check that out, and we will have all the information, the news, the latest notes, as well as some bonus material. So we like to have fun on that show, just like the convention itself. So if you've got a convention that you want us to help promote or you want us to help participate in, please reach out to us. Also, if you're going to a convention that we're not at, please reach out to us, contact us, send us an email, give us a call, ask to come on the show, because we love talking about conventions and we want to have you part of the show.
So that's going to wrap up another episode. Thank you so much for joining us for the book club. Mike, you did a great job at hosting that second.
It's fun. It's fun to moderate. And, you know, I don't have to do much because you guys are great to talk to. So it's pretty easy.
Anything you want to shout out about to, sir?
Me, I'm going to shout out, you know, since a lot of people are probably interested in comics here, I do have to give a shout out to a new book by Gail Simone, who's one of my favorite writers, and Kat Staggs, who's a great artist in his own right. And it's a new book called Crosswind. It's available from Image. It's a creator-owned book for Gail, and it's really fun. I read the first issue. It came out last week. Really, really good, dark book. So if you like dark stories like Watchmen, I'm not saying it's that dark, but Gail's put her own twist on a very cliche trope that we've seen many times before, but I'm sure that where this series is going, that it's going to be not typical for anybody. So I would definitely recommend that pick.
That is awesome. And Kevin, thank you so much, my friend.
Hey, it's always great to get up here on the station, guys. This was fun, and a pleasure to talk about one of my all-time favorite books.
Hey, congratulations, by the way, on your 5th anniversary.
Absolutely, sir.
Yeah, that was a few weeks back. We passed the 5-year mark over here in Chickentown at the Flopcast, and we have not missed a week. We've literally released a podcast every 7 days for over 5 years now.
That's impressive.
They should have awards for that, you know? You know?
I see where you're going with that, Mike.
Yeah. I wasn't going to say a word. Nothing. Uh-huh. No comments, but it is great. You guys, I listen every week, and it's always fun. Always wondering what is the 4.5 list this week, or what is National Whatever Day?
We are doing something really weird on the Flopcast through the whole summer. Every week for the next 10 weeks, we're watching an obscure old kids show called High Feather and encouraging all our listeners to watch as well. And then we discuss this goofy show from the early 80s. Set at a summer camp that nobody remembers except us, and that's how we're going to torture our listeners all summer long.
Wow, that's a way of keeping an audience. Gee,
that's right. It's a challenge.
He's like, you know, we've been doing this for 5 years. It's time to trim the herd.
That's
wow. That's just
roll
that just
the other way now.
Exactly. That just sounds like a David Lynch show or something. That... Wow. Drew, thank you so much, my friend.
Thanks for having me on. Love talking Watchmen.
Oh, definitely. And you want to do a promotion of your little podcast?
Oh, yes. Come check out the Earth Station DCU. We talk DC news, DC comics. We talk DC television shows, especially the CW shows, Flash, Arrow, Supergirl, Legends, and soon Black Lightning. So we talk about the DC movies, Wonder Woman. Cletus and I did a Watchmen episode also, episode 16. You can check it out. We talk a lot about the dynamics of the Watchmen, plus how it ties into the current Rebirth DCU. So check that out.
Oh, most definitely worth checking out. All right.
Hey, Mike, before you give you a shout out, I do have to mention two real quick, because they're both here, that I want to announce that as many listeners know, we are doing a second volume of Tales of the Station, which will be available at Dragon Con this year, and then it'll be available online as well. But people can pick up print copies at Dragon Con. And I just, you know, slowly but surely, we're announcing our participants, and we've got two of the authors of stories on our podcast right now. I'll let the listeners guess who they are. No, actually, Kevin and Drew are being published in the new volume. And yes, they both made the cut.
Wow. And both of them are just finding that out now. So that's awesome.
Yeah, what is this? I just farmed it out to my ghostwriters. I don't know what those guys put together this time.
But it went chickens on a keyboard, right?
That's right.
They were pecking out that story.
You line up a million chickens at a million typewriters.
It did kind of feel a little foul.
Well, I could tell you, all you guys are in my story, so...
It's true. It's true. Mike, it is very telling that and how these reading all these stories, we're pretty much in all of them. And not to give away too many spoilers, but we might have to rethink our attitude towards other people on the network, because we die in a lot of them. I just find that odd. So,
well, you know, you guys do know that if Mike or I perish, William takes over. And no, so, you know, you had to start sucking up to the kid. Just remember that.
So if, you know, if people out there want to, experience what it would be like if Mike and I perished horribly in some cases.
Selling books.
If you didn't get enough of it in volume one, wait till you pick up volume two. It's almost disturbing.
Wow. I'm almost frightened now. Ugh. And they want me to write the foreword for this thing? I lived, I died. What can I say?
There you go.
Exactly. So this is going to be the last time we hear from these two on the show then.
That's right.
So we're looking for new people to join the network. No, just kidding.
I regret nothing.
My shout out actually real quick is twofold. First off, I wanted to give a happy 30th anniversary to Spaceballs, the Mel Brooks classic. Now, can you believe the Schwartz is now 30 years old? And it's just amazing to think that, you know, the same time almost Watchmen came out, Spaceballs was out too. And it's just,
now
you do feel old. And well, because if you think about it, John Candy passed away in the early 90s, I think. So
like knowing that Watchmen wasn't whatever it is, 40 years old.
Yeah, it's not 40 years old. Watchmen's not 40 years old yet, dude.
No, 30?
30.
Came out in 80, it ended in 87. So yeah, 30.
Yeah. Yep. So no, 40. Ooh,
that's still old.
No, because that means you and I will be going to our 40th anniversary of graduation, dude.
Yeah, I don't go to those, but yes, go ahead.
Okay. I also wanted to, of course, thank Al from the wonderful Night Blogger podcast joining us in the Geeksy tonight. And you know, folks, we are growing. The ESO Network is adding new shows. We have a lot of neat things coming up. And we are, you know, want to hear from you guys. Of course, you know, you could write us esopodcast@gmail.com, or you could, of course, you know, call us up at 404-963-9057. But, you know, if you have a podcast or a podcast idea, please feel free, write us, let us know what your ideas are. We'd love hearing about it. We have a couple other new shows coming in the wings, and you're going to be hearing from a couple of them in the next couple weeks. So, you know, we're going to continue to grow. And you know, I remember when these fresh faces were like, can we join the network? We'd really like that. Well, actually, I think Kevin was a wary veteran at the time. Yeah, what the hell, I'll join your network, what the hell.
That's right.
I thought I remember somebody asking me if I wanted to do a podcast.
I don't know what you're talking about. So you know, we had roles to fill and people to take it, and he was foolish enough to listen to me. But we love you guys at home, and you know, ESO is about family. It's about growth, and these guys have been fantastic. All our shows have been, and you know, please give them all a listen. You know, as we like to say, we can't do this without you. We probably would be talking to each other anyway, but we'd like talking to you guys, and we definitely love hearing from you guys. Feedback, or people have been rating us up on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, wherever you listen to the show, please feel free, you know, rate us or just leave feedback. It takes 2 seconds to, you know, rate us 5 stars. And if you want to leave 1 star, we're the Nerdist. Just remember, look under that one. So with that being said, we are going to be back again next week when we take a look at the works of Guy Ritchie. That's right. We're doing a director spotlight, and Lacey will be back with us, and we are going to be looking at all the work of Guy Ritchie and looking at Sherlock, the Sherlock Holmes movies he did. We're going to be looking, of course, at Snatch and Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. We might even touch on that King Arthur movie he just did. You never know. But we have a lot to talk about, so we will be back then. Until then, my name is Mike Faber, and we will see you here on the Earth Station One podcast. Peace. And we're done.
You've been listening to Earth Station One, a weekly podcast that explores the many worlds of all things geek. Please write us at esopodcast@gmail.com or call us at 404-963-9057. And if we find what you say interesting, we'll put it up on the air. If you've enjoyed our show, please rate us or leave feedback for us up on iTunes. And while you're there, subscribe to our show or any of the ESO Network podcasts. We can also be found up on Stitcher Radio or wherever fine podcasts are found. ESO is also available up on most social media sites like Facebook, Twitter, and so many more. The show is brought to you by the fine folks at the ESO Amazon.com eStore, where right from our website you can find all kind of geeky goodness. And if you get something up there, you also help support the station. ESO also has a Zazzle store to buy cool ESO merchandise and such. Show your ESO love with something from Zazzle. To learn more about ESO, our website is esopodcast.com. The show is produced by Calico Productions. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you here next time on the Earth Station One podcast. Peace.
That's it. The show's over. It's time to head home. See you next week here at Earth Station One.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.